Nuclear waste, nuclear worries.
We're killing the Earth from global warming. We're killing it from nuclear waste, and we're killing it from massive nuclear accidents. We have to wake up.
Plus, preserving land and wildlife. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, the Women's Perspective. Japan's Nuclear Regulatory Authority is now dealing with a new emergency. Contaminated water from the ruined Fukushima nuclear plant has spilled over underground walls built to contain it. The watchdog group warns that levels of radioactivity in the Pacific Ocean will rapidly rise unless active measures are taken quickly. Tens of thousands of tons of radioactive water were dumped into the Pacific as an emergency measure shortly after the plant was destroyed by an earthquake and tsunami in 2011. Fukushima has had a massive impact on the global conversation about nuclear power. Germany vowed to shut down all of its nuclear power plants by 2022 in response to the Fukushima meltdown. Nobel Prize winner Dr. Helen Caldicott, an anti-nuclear activist, is featured in this report on the long-term health impacts of nuclear accidents. Martha Baskin of Green Acres Radio also spoke with a documentary filmmaker whose film remembers the chaotic aftermath of the Fukushima disaster.
If you want an impassioned opinion about the dangers of nuclear power, talk to Dr. Helen Caldicott, the Nobel Peace Prize winner and co-founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility, has been alerting the public since she was a medical student in Australia.
And at that time, 1956, Russia and America were blowing up bombs in the atmosphere with impunity, and I couldn't understand as a young medical student why they were doing it, because it was so obvious what the genetic implications would be.
Radiation is passed from generation to generation. Like strontium-90 and cesium, radiation is released from nuclear reactors and linked to cancer and leukemia.
The incubation time for cancer, however, is the magical ace up the sleeve of the nuclear industry, because it takes 5 years post-radiation to get leukemia and 15 to 70 years to develop a cancer from a radiation dose you received many years ago. And the cancer, when it arises, doesn't wear a little sign saying what caused it.
But something new in the history of medicine is happening at Fukushima, says Caldicott. 30% of 3,000 children examined who received a very high dose of radiation have been diagnosed with thyroid tumors.
Now that's really early. That's within the first year. That's unheard of.
In the documentary Surviving Japan, local filmmaker Chris Noland brings us up close and personal. Noland lived in Tokyo at the time of the nuclear disaster and volunteered with relief agencies. After meeting people whose voices weren't being heard, he decided to tell their story.
I kind of empathized with them because I had the same questions, and they weren't getting answered for me either.
Questions like, what would the physical effects be?
They told us what happened, but they really didn't tell us what it would do to, like, our body or anything. And then they went back and kind of backpedaled and said, this is how the nuclear power plant works. Nothing about the health effects.
In the film, Nolan joins journalists seeking information from government officials and TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company. Finally, he meets the mayor of the besieged town of Minamisoma, who went on YouTube to beg the world for supplies. Mayor Sakori was one of the first officials to break the silence and speak against Japan's investment in nuclear energy. Nuclear power is not the answer, says Mayor Sakori. We need an alternative. This is an important time, not only for Japan, but for the entire world to start focusing on renewable energy. Again, Dr. Helen Caldicott.
Fukushima, I predict, means the end of the nuclear power industry, and it's already happening in Japan. Look, 30% of its electricity was generated by nuclear power. Now they had 54 reactors, only two are now running.
She says Americans need to learn social responsibility and say no to nuclear power.
We're killing the Earth from global warming. We're killing it from nuclear waste, and we're killing it from massive nuclear accidents. We have to wake up.
In Surviving Japan, documentary filmmaker Chris Noland shares the story of Yumeya Keller, a single mother who evacuated herself and her children after witnessing the first explosion. Keller says the government initially defined only a small area close to the reactor as being at risk.
Government and TEPCO wanted to keep the areas small so that they don't have to pay too much money. The real victim here are children. They have done nothing wrong. We have responsibility to protect them.
Tom Buchanan with Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility says there's a lesson for Washington. The biggest fear at Fukushima was that the four plants' spent fuel pools would set on fire.
But our spent fuel at the old Whoops plant, which is called the Columbia Generating Station, right on the Columbia now, out at Hanford, has more spent fuel in their pools than the entire four reactors at Fukushima.
Hanford holds the largest amount of nuclear waste in the Western Hemisphere. For more about the film Surviving Japan, go to survivingjapan.com.
Germany faces a massive problem as it tries to decommission its power plants. What to do with the nuclear waste? According to German nuclear experts, the operation and decommissioning of the country's reactors will produce over 6.1 million cubic feet of low to medium level radioactive waste that has to be stored underground safely for a million years. It's a huge task that the Germans say they won't complete until 2080 at the earliest. Meanwhile, there are concerns in the U.S. about Canada's plans for storing its nuclear waste. Ontario Power Generation is proposing construction of an underground, permanent burial facility for all of Ontario's low and intermediate level radioactive waste. The proposed site is less than a mile inland from the shore of Lake Huron and about 120 miles upstream from the main drinking water intakes for southeastern Michigan. In May, the Michigan State Senate unanimously voted to oppose the project. Sean Parrish with WTIP has more.
Will a nuclear waste storage facility be constructed in the Lake Superior Basin? The answer is possibly. Canada's Nuclear Waste Management Organization, the NWMO, is presently looking for a site to construct a storage facility where nuclear waste will be buried in rock 500 meters to 1 kilometer underground. Based on geological features, areas near Lake Superior are suitable for such a facility, and some communities on the Canadian North Shore have expressed interest in the project. Recently, officials from Nipigon, Ontario, traveled to Toronto and met with representatives of NWMO for a detailed briefing and a tour of the Pickering Waste Management Facility, where nuclear waste is currently stored on an interim basis. The visit was called a Learn More opportunity. Mayor Richard Harvey emphatically states this does not mean Nipigon has tossed its hat into the ring as a potential nuclear storage site. Nipigon has not in any way said we want the nuclear waste here, said Harvey in a recent interview. We want to learn more about the process and inform our citizens. The fact that we are asking questions doesn't mean we are moving forward. Nipigon leaders decided to learn more about nuclear waste storage after discovering that two neighboring North Shore communities, nearby Red Rock and Scriber, which is about 60 miles to the east, were investigating the potential of hosting the nuclear waste facility. While it was determined Red Rock did not have the proper geology for a storage site, Scriber remains in the running. Other northwestern Ontario communities, such as Ignace, which is about 100 miles west of Thunder Bay, are interested in the project, as are several communities in Saskatchewan. Their interest concerns Nipigon, which is located at the northernmost point of Lake Superior. On the edge of town are two bridges over the mighty Nipigon River, one for the Trans-Canada Highway and the other for the nation's railroad. There is no other river crossing, so nearly all of the goods and people moving across Canada must pass this point. If the nuclear waste storage facility is located further west, nuclear waste will cross these bridges too. The NWMO wants the underground storage to be secure for 100,000 years. The storage site must have stable geological features, preferably solid granite with no fractures, groundwater, or mineral deposits. Fractures or groundwater could lead to eventual leakage or contamination. Any minerals may someday be mined, which could also fracture the rock. For northern communities, becoming the site of the nuclear waste facility could be an economic windfall. Sluggish demand for forest products has led to the closure of many northern Ontario mills and logging operations. Harvey said the entire industrial base of Nipigon and Red Rock was wiped out in the past 6 years. He was told the nuclear waste facility could bring 400 to 500 full-time jobs for the next 30 years and beyond. However, he doesn't think communities, particularly his own, should decide to enter the site selection process solely on a promise of jobs. The big issue is perception, he says. How does it fit with the vision of who we are and where we are going? The Nipigon area has been a tourism destination since the 1800s. Not long ago, the Canadian government established a marine conservation area that encompasses much of Lake Superior, its wild shores and islands, near Nipigon. The community is in the early stages of developing a master plan for its marina and waterfront, in part to take advantage of new tourism opportunities. Tourism development and nuclear waste storage may not be compatible for the community. Harvey says some community members are adamantly opposed to even considering nuclear waste storage, but many are staying neutral until they learn more about it. While the jobs would be welcome, Nipigon is starting to recover from the loss of its industrial base through new jobs provided by healthcare, education, government services, and entrepreneurs. This is not necessarily true in other northern communities. Other communities may say yes to entering the selection process, and economics will be the deciding factor, he says. Ultimately, the Canadian government is leaving it up to communities to decide if they want to host the nuclear waste facility. Without overwhelming community support, the project will not move forward. And even though it seems Nipigon is an unlikely candidate, Harvey thinks the facility could end up somewhere on the north side of Lake Superior. If that is the case, he wants to make sure his community is well-informed and has a voice. This is Sean Parrish with Points North.
The waste storage project falls under Canada's regulations, not those of the United States. Up next, trying to preserve land both in the city and in the countryside. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1259. In June, a $940 billion House version of the five-year 2013 Farm Bill was defeated because of partisan disagreements over a food stamp cut included in the bill. But that bill also funds 20 agricultural conservation programs, such as the Conservation Reserve Program. The House's 2013 Farm Bill reduces conservation spending by $6 billion over the next 5 years, trims CRP's current enrollment by 8 million acres, and eliminates several programs through consolidation. For 27 years, the popular Conservation Reserve Program has transformed small parcels of land. It is credited with contributing to cleaner water, more habitat for migrating birds, and less soil erosion. But as Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports from Iowa, the program has been enrolling fewer acres in recent years, and it isn't just about government funding.
Environmental specialist Sean McCoy works for the Iowa Department of Agriculture. He's driving to a spot in Boone County where there's a brand new wetland thanks to the Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP.
This is like the headwaters of the Onion Creek watershed right here, the beginning of it. And this is all CRP here, this whole big 80 acres here.
Pectoral sandpipers peck along the shore of this new small pond. Canada geese float on the water. Two landowners here will get payments from the federal government in exchange for not farming this land for 10 or 15 years and implementing a conservation plan. McCoy says water will pool here in the spring and fall, providing habitat for these birds. Then native plants will take over.
In the years to come, that vegetation will denitrify all the nitrates that are in the water.
Water that comes from 500 acres of mostly farmland. The state partners with the U.S. Department of Agriculture to expand CRP's reach. This new wetland will contribute to a larger watershed project McCoy coordinates.
We want to improve the health of the watershed, to improve the health of the water, and to improve the health of everything downstream, I think, you know. So that's kind of the way I look at it.
That greater good notion fuels state-federal partnerships, but it doesn't necessarily motivate farmers. In 2012, CRP paid farmers $1.7 billion. The number of acres enrolled in the program peaked in 2007. It has fallen every year since. Last year saw the lowest enrollment since 1989. High grain prices are one reason farmers keep farming. But 3 hours southeast, in Washington, Iowa, farmer John Berto is committed to conservation.
We've done field borders, we've done the strips along creeks, and bought anything we can to conserve soil for my sons and my grandsons.
He's had acres enrolled in CRP since at least 1995.
This used to be a little three-cornered patch. It came with the farm and was, oh, there goes some deer.
We've stopped beside an 8-acre CRP-funded tree stand.
The government paid me some real money and we planted it to these trees and it's just turned out beautiful.
It also helps prevent erosion. The USDA says CRP projects have restored millions of acres of wetlands and kept hundreds of millions of pounds of nitrogen and phosphorus out of waterways nationwide. Berto sees the benefits for long-term soil health and does some conservation work without help from Uncle Sam. That's because he sees the fertility of his land as his son's future.
I'm 62 years old. If it wasn't for my two sons, I'd run this operation another till I'm 70 or something, and I'd farm it fence row to fence row.
With today's high grain prices, some farmers are choosing not to renew CRP contracts as they expire. That's a trend Mark Rasmussen has noticed in Iowa. He's director of the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture at Iowa State University.
We've got a lot of CRP land that has been brought back out into production. In driving around the state these past few months, I've seen a lot of piles of trees sitting around, too, where little small acres, little odd corners and fields have that used to be in trees or something have been pulled out so that that land can be brought into production, too.
So while today you can drive across the Midwest and see trees, birds, and grasses on land the federal government has paid farmers to stop farming, those vistas may not last. Contracts on 3.3 million acres of CRP land will expire in September. By then, there should be a new farm bill, and we'll find out how much land it allows for CRP and how many farmers choose to stick with or join the program. I'm Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Now let's look at the flip side of the coin, trying to preserve wildlife habitat in a densely populated city. Wildlife has made a comeback in New York City thanks to careful protection of what limited habitats there are. Urban sprawl has been shrinking the animals' old habitats, yet the improving condition of urban lands and waterways has made the city more hospitable. But ongoing development threatens animals even in their new habitats. Call it habitat squeeze. An excellent example was a proposed development in Staten Island, the construction of a NASCAR short track that was expected to draw 80,000 racing fans with a view of the New York City skyline. Kristen Esplin filed this story when the battle between environmentalists and developers was heating up, a battle that actually led to police ending a 2006 meeting early to avert what they feared would be a riot. Stay tuned after the story. It has a new, recent twist.
In New York's tight real estate market, developers scramble for the last available open spaces and even for abandoned buildings. But it wasn't always that way. In the 1800s, landowners set aside huge tracts of land for several major parks. One example is at the northern tip of the Bronx, at the end of the number 6 subway line.
This is the last stop on this train. Everyone, please leave the train.
Outside the subway, take the overpass across the Bruckner Expressway, and you're in Pelham Bay Park. It's New York City's largest, more than three times the size of Central Park. David Berg is a naturalist who founded a conservation organization called Wild Metro. He monitors wildlife in Pelham Bay. Walking into the forested part of the nature preserve, Berg said before it was a park, it was private land.
There's been various families who have had estates on this island for years until the late 1880s, the mid-1880s, when this was made into a city park. At the time it was made into city park, the Bronx hadn't really even been created yet, but the city fathers had foresight to preserve some big lands and more foresight about protecting natural area then than we have now, interestingly enough. We're in an area here where we did research and we found incredibly high densities of small mammals. Well, Metro did research with little live traps, which we captured the animals and let them go, and just amazing. Usually you expect to have to maybe one-third of your traps have animals. We found sometimes three-quarters, 75% trap rate, and which is interesting, high density, but also pretty good variety. There was some unusual voles and flying squirrels here.
The City Parks Department, which owns and manages the land where those small mammals live, has a branch that tries to acquire more natural lands like Pelham Bay Park. It's called the Natural Resources Group, and its director, Bill Tai, says shorefronts in particular are critical to the city's environmental health.
And a good portion of those are natural tidal wetlands that serve as both filters for material coming out into the oceans from rivers and small creeks in the upland areas, and they also serve as barriers to wave action and flooding from the ocean side. They also serve as habitat for many different species.
Tai's agency had been eyeing some shorefront land on Staten Island's northern shore. It's one of the largest privately owned properties left in the city, a former petroleum storage site that bears the scars of years of industrial harm, including contaminated soil. International Speedway Corporation, or ISC, had been eyeing the land too. The company, which owns the racetracks where NASCAR drivers compete, bought it. Bill Tai of the Natural Resources Group says the city missed its moment.
What we're losing is the opportunity to protect a large parcel of natural habitat that serves a purpose for not only people but nature and provides benefits to the public and New Yorkers in ways, too, that are not easily quantifiable.
Jim Otto represents the northern shore of Staten Island in City Council.
My reaction was probably the same reaction every Staten Islander had, and that's you want to build a stadium where?
At one point, Staten Island could boast about its open space and suburban feel. Now, Staten Island is one of the fastest-growing communities in the state.
This problem is 40-plus years in the making, and what people didn't realize was as we were growing, we were filling the glass, and the glass only started spilling over in the 1990s. We reached that critical mass where everyone is absolutely frustrated.
Otto says the extra traffic carrying a potential 30,000 fans to NASCAR races on weekends would overwhelm the island's already clogged bridges and roads.
You're not going to have private property like this just sit there and no one use it. So you knew at some point that somebody would come in with some sort of proposal. And again, it's zone manufacturing, so it's going to have some sort of, you know, heavy industrial component to it. I think because of the degree of the remediation required, that's been a little bit daunting to people, and that's why it took some entity with really deep pockets to come along and purchase it.
ISC Vice President John Graham says the company is betting $500 million that having a track in New York City would be worth the cost of any environmental remediation. Bill Tai from the city's Natural Resources Group says trade-offs like these can, over time, tip the scales against wildlife.
Nature is vibrant and it can recover. I guess it's more accurate to say, too, that because of incremental development, 10 acres here and 10 acres there and 100 acres here and 100 acres there do add up. And so it's a constant continuing struggle to stem the tide of the incremental degradation of habitat.
Tai says his only hope is to keep his eyes open for properties the city might be able to acquire and then be the top bidder.
The plain truth of it is there are parcels to be purchased and acquired and protected all around the city, but they're few and far between at this point.
Now, the challenge for New Yorkers may simply be to find ways to reconcile the built and natural environments. I'm Kristen Espeland, Columbia Radio News.
ISC dropped the project in 2006. Just this month, it was announced it has sold the property to Staten Island Marine Development, which plans to use the site for commercial development and wetland restoration under an agreement it reached with the state. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Ellen Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. If you'd like to connect with us on Facebook, you can find 51% there, and you can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.